From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made earlier this week when the Department of Justice finally released a detailed report on Ferguson. It was 6 months ago that 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot and killed by police officer Darren Wilson. The Justice Department determined that it would not bring criminal charges against Officer Wilson. The 86-page report determined that Officer Wilson had apparently acted in self-defense. But the DOJ was not done there. Beyond that single incident involving Officer Wilson and Michael Brown, the DOJ looked at the broader picture of what was happening in Ferguson. And what investigators found was, for many of us, shocking. Racist emails, one of them joking that a black woman who had an abortion should receive a check for $5,000 from Crime Stoppers. Another remark that President Obama wouldn't stay president for very long because, quote, what black man holds a steady job for 4 years? There was more. The statistics show just how disproportionate the arrests are, the stop and searches are, the jail time. The DOJ declared that there was a pattern of racism in Ferguson. Some of the practices were unconstitutional. This hour, we are not going to adjudicate the Michael Brown case. Instead, we're taking a wider look at Ferguson, racism. We're asking what we all can do to make sure Ferguson is the exception, not the rule. And that does not suppose that Ferguson is the rule. But let's have a good conversation this hour with our guests. Marvin McMichael is here. He's the president of Colgate-Rochester-Crozier Divinity School. Dr. McMichael, thank you for being
here. Thank you for inviting me.
Also here is Marvin Steverson, a retired Rochester sergeant in the police department there and now a professor at Roberts Wesleyan College who helped develop a curriculum for an ethic and social diversity course in the Criminal Justice Administration program. Retired Sergeant Steverson, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And also here is Mark Concordia, who's the director of the Criminal Justice Administration Program at Roberts Wesleyan, teaches undergrads there. He spent 13 years with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. He's worked in corrections, federal law enforcement, and with the Greece Police Department as well. Mark, thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Evan.
I want to start with Dr. McMichael, I should say, when it comes to the report, and I know we've seen some of the details now. I read just two of the examples of emails. The Washington Post cited 7 racist emails. I say they shock me. I don't know if they shock you, but I think they probably should at the very least disturb us. How did you feel about it?
Yeah, they are shocking.
Yeah.
Whether or not, from my point of view, I'm shocked that white police officers in Ferguson would engage in this kind of banter between themselves is not surprising. I'm very much taken by a comment made by one of Michael Brown's lawyers this morning when he observed that you've got to keep in mind now that the context out of which Darren Wilson was working on the day that Michael Brown was shot was this context that assumes a certain racial bias, that assumes the liberty to speak in a certain kind of way, and which probably looks upon a particular person through a jaundiced eye to begin with. But if you ask me, born and raised in Chicago, and then lived in New York and lived in Cleveland and now lives in Rochester, if racism on the part of white police officers, even in their emails, is surprising, hardly.
Mark, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to preface my comments on the fact that that's a 100-page report, and I've done a preliminary analysis on it.
Sure, sure.
A more extensive read is going to take some time, but I would have to agree with the doctor that the report is shocking. My analysis of the DOJ report does suggest the necessity for the criminal justice system to take bold and innovative steps to address disproportionality of contacts, arrests, and incarcerations of African-American males and Hispanic males in our system. But what's equally not as surprising is the disparity rates. They're not that off from rates that we're seeing around the country. And, you know, a data analysis, a deeper dive of the data needs to occur here to get accurate measures of whether they're really instructive towards discriminatory process or speak to larger social issues like poverty and education.
Sure. And to what Mark is talking about, I opened by mentioning the very obviously racist emails. Mark is referring to statistics. Here's what the DOJ found. Despite making up 67% of the population in Ferguson, African Americans accounted for 85% of Ferguson police's traffic stops, 90% of citations, 93% of arrests. Here is, but it doesn't really stop there. And here's where you start to see an even more, for me, this is where it stands in real relief here. African Americans, more than twice as likely to be searched during a vehicular stop. But African Americans are 26% less likely to have contraband on them during a vehicle stop. Mm-hmm. So police can't say, all right, we're twice as likely to search a black person, but more often than not, they've got contraband. Mm-hmm. No, they have it less. Mm-hmm. They have it less. So those are some of the stats that Mark is talking about, and we're going to get into more of that. But let me also ask retired Sergeant Steverson, your thoughts on just a preliminary look at the emails and some of the numbers that Mark's talked about.
When I look at it, I think back about the iceberg formula where you talk about what you see on top, and you have to understand that there's a lot more that's still to be exposed. Given the history of America, as far as it is people of color, we, again, as a law enforcement community, are just a small microcosm of the main community. So if we still have struggles 400-plus years later with our main community as far as the Academy Awards or the Oscars, where we're not getting fair representation in those venues, then you're going to have that same situation within law enforcement as it pertains to hiring practices, promotions, and then training, so on and so forth, that is more targeted towards their clientele, which, if in an urban environment, is going to be a larger capacity of black and brown residents.
I want to hear some comments from the mayor of Ferguson, and that's James Knowles. He had some comments after this report came out, and we're going to listen, and we'll get some feedback from our panel as well. And if you want to join the conversation this hour, you can. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. This is Ferguson Mayor James Knowles responding specifically to the overtly racist emails that were uncovered in this DOJ report. Let's listen.
Let me be clear. This type of behavior will not be tolerated in the Ferguson Police Department or in any department of the city of Ferguson. Immediately upon leaving that meeting, the three individuals were placed on administrative leave pending an investigation. One has since been terminated, and the other two are still awaiting the outcome of an internal investigation. These actions taken by these individuals are in no way representative of the employees of the city of Ferguson. But today's report allows the city of Ferguson to identify the problems not only in our police department, but in the entire St. Louis region. We must do better, not only as a city, but as a state and a country.
All right, so that's Ferguson Mayor James Knowles. Now, Dr. McMichael, a couple of points here. On some of the emails that we've seen, and I could read more, and frankly, I don't want to spend the hour reading all of this really just ugly, awful stuff. I mean, it's just depressingly terrible stuff. From June 2011, an email described a man seeking to obtain welfare for his dogs because, quote, they are mixed in color, unemployed, lazy, can't speak English, and have no freaking clue who their daddies are. Another email depicted President Obama as a chimpanzee. African Americans were mocked about child support. One line from an email read, I'd be so glad that this be my last child support payment, month after month, year after year, all those payments. Okay, here's the thing. We know those are racist emails. 2 points. We don't exactly know who within the city structure of government sent those emails, but we know that some city leaders saw them and there was no discipline until this week. No discipline. But the mayor is saying this is not representative of the culture of Ferguson. They're going to handle this. They're already instituting some discipline. Do you accept his comment that this is not representative of the feeling there?
It seems to me that the issue largely is not about emails. If that was all we were dealing with, that would be one thing.
Sure.
The issue is about the fact that there is a pattern, and the DOJ has demonstrated this, of these arrests for very minor violations, traffic violations or jaywalking violations, which often result in financial fines, which if you cannot pay, may result ultimately in arrest and incarceration, which then have the really strong possibility of causing you to lose a job or not be able to qualify for some other opportunity. And the danger here is that the city of Ferguson has decided essentially to fund itself significantly on the backs of African Americans who are being arrested for petty offenses and are being, one has to assume, targeted to that end, 2 miles over the speed limit or whatever the case might be. So it seems to me that we can't just talk about emails. We have to talk about the policy that results in the massive numbers of persons who line up, as they describe it, outside of the court system every day to pay off these fines. And if you can't pay them off, they put you in jail. Is the mayor going to stop that policy as well?
Well, those are fair points. And then here are some more statistics that support what you just heard from Dr. McMichael. African Americans, because sometimes you have an offense against you, but you can contest it. It can be thrown out. African Americans, 68% less likely than non-African Americans to have their case dismissed by a municipal judge. And in 2013 in Ferguson, African Americans accounted for 92% of cases in which an arrest warrant was issued. African Americans are more likely to receive multiple citations during one single incident, receiving 4 or more citations on 73 different occasions between October of 2012 and July 2014, whereas non-African Americans received 4 or more citations only 2 times during that period. 2 times. And as Dr. McMichael says, you've got multiple citations. They are going to, and what we have seen in Ferguson, they're going to pursue those in ways that can cause you to spend jail time, to lose jobs, et cetera. So to you, is that overtly racist, Dr. McMichael?
To the extent that it appears that this is a pattern that disproportionately falls upon a part of the population, that these are not crimes that are bringing society to a halt. You know, these are not armed robberies. These are not breaking and entering. These are not rape. These are not drug trafficking charges. It's two issues. One, it is the way by which a city chooses to fund itself. And two, it seems to do it disproportionately at the expense of a particular part of the population. So I would call it at least racial targeting. This is a population that we can get away with doing this to. And it's been going on for a long time.
Yeah, Eric Holder, Attorney General, called it an unconstitutional practice that you're hearing described.
I mean, it's almost a violation of the Fourth Amendment, unreasonable search and seizure.
Well, as the phones start to ring, we're going to get to your phone calls. But I also want to touch on another stat that we have. In Ferguson, African Americans have force used against them at disproportionately high rates, accounting for 88% of all cases from 2010 to 2014 in which a Ferguson police officer used force. And in all 14 uses of force involving a canine bite for which there is information about the race of the person bitten, all of them were black. So let me ask our retired police officers in the room about this before I get to your phone calls, because I think it was a couple of weeks ago that we had Bill Johnson and Bill Clark on this program talking about this issue. The Urban League of Rochester celebrating 50 years, marking 50 years. They say they are here because they need to be. And they talked about a lot of these issues. And we had several callers call the program and say, well, just because 88%, for example, of cases of force in Ferguson are against African Americans and only 60% of the population is African American doesn't mean the police did anything wrong. Just because more people who are arrested in Ferguson are African American than the population doesn't mean the police did anything wrong. Mark, our callers were saying, you've got to show me more than that. And then several pointed to, and we talked about on the program, former presidential candidate and New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani's comments in which he said, white police officers have confrontations with black Americans because they have to go into black neighborhoods because that's where the violence is. Mm. What do you think, Mark?
Well, it's once again, when we talk about data and we talk about statistics, we have to be leery on drawing absolute conclusions based solely on the data and statistics. And I'll actually cite a USA report, USA Today report, and it says that at least 1,581 other police departments across the U.S. arrest black people at rates even more skewed than in Ferguson. And I'll quote a professor, Dr. David Harris of Pittsburgh, who says that does not mean police are discriminating, but it does mean that it's worth looking at. And it means you might have a problem and you need to pay attention. Okay, that's Professor David Harris. Now, what I mean by that, though, is once again, I was as a true measure of discriminatory practices, you would have to have the raw data and a deep dive into the data. But I think when you combine the statistics and the data that we saw in the DOJ report with some of the manifestations of explicit racism, and which more shockingly is, you talked about the emails, but there was also interviews that were conducted of community members and extensive interviews of police officers, is that the emails were generated by supervisors. And when you get explicit manifestations of racism from bosses, that tends to send a message to the entire department. So while I am skeptical of the data, and I can understand where some of your callers are coming from saying, well, hey, wait a minute, if there's 93% of the arrests are African American, and there's going to be higher rates of use of force and incidents there. I understand that logic. And that's why the data we have to be skeptical about. But when you look at the report in its totality, and you see leaders, you see supervisors with which, you know, this, like I said, this explicit manifestation of racism is just not accepted in any way, shape, or form in today's society, specifically within law enforcement. But to think that that was accepted and not dealt with speaks to the greater issue.
Did you ever see anything like that in your years in law enforcement?
No. Explicit, no. Did it manifest in the patrol car when somebody else wasn't there?
No, I understand.
Right. In my experience, no, because it's not tolerated. But to have this being a practice is very illustrative of what was happening down there. And you understand the explosion of frustration. And Michael Brown case aside, you understand the explosion of frustration, the narrative of the people of Ferguson. But back to my other point is data can be manipulated. So we have to be careful of that. And but we can't ignore what was happening there. And paradigm shifts in policing is what we need to be talking about. You mentioned Rudy Giuliani. And there's this concept that some police departments still adhere to, is the broken windows concept. All right, the theory of broken windows. You enforce the small petty crimes, the jaywalking, the vandalism, and you reduce crime in general. That's a crime fighter mentality, and that worked potentially. Well, it worked in New York City. And some police departments maintain that. And when you have higher crime rates, they see that as an acceptable means or a paradigm how to police its citizens with no regard to how that affects police community relations.
Professor Steverson?
I have to agree with Mark as far as with the numbers. And again, it depends on which way, what side of the coin you're looking at. The numbers can either support your argument or, you know, it can dispute it. And with given the incidents that have taken place in Ferguson, along with the numbers, you have to believe that the numbers are accurate, because there has to be the understanding of why there's rage, why there's a high volume of the similar stories amongst the community. You know, this is not just your criminals complaining. You know, as a sergeant, when I was an officer beforehand, you know, I would step out with guys who were on the corner for a lengthy period of time all day long and have no place to go or anything to do. And then when you step out with them, it's the same story. Oh, you're just harassing me because I'm hanging out. Well, no, it's because you're in front of this place, you got people walking up to you, and I'm seeing things that are taking place that are consistent with drug selling or buying, wherein if you were walking from your home and to a store and back again, there's a purpose there. I don't have a reason to stop you. But when you have behavior that is not reasonable, then I have a reason to stop you. And the thing is that these reports that were coming out of Ferguson, folk were just walking down the street. They hadn't seen anything before or what led up to a reason why they want to stop this individual. So now when you have a report that came off of CNN saying that you got 94% of people getting cited for walking and then 95% for non-compliance, well, of course, if I'm just walking and you haven't seen me do anything else illegal, I'm going to be upset and not comply. Okay, and then you're going to see the use of force numbers go up because now I feel like you're violating my rights. And then you're going to see the escalation of violence, wherein this individual is going to assault the officer, or the officer is going to end up doing like Michael Brown, being shot by the officer because he had to protect his life now because this individual was refusing to comply. And so I think that you have to take the numbers along with other outside stimulus and believe that what you're seeing, like the Eric Garner video, what you're seeing is what you're actually seeing.
Let me get to the phones, and let me bring in Paul Narondekoit, who's been waiting to weigh in. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, I agree with exactly what these guys are saying, and I listen to Eric Holder, who's very well spoken. I think the point being made overall is the regulatory society is out of control, and I think it affects everything business-wise and everything else that has the regulatory problems. And that's what they're doing. They're taking regulations and they're determining through the police department that it's criminal activity, and they're going after the people. And I'm really against it. I'm really upset by it also. And I'd like to say that's what happened with Eric Garner in New York. He sold some cigarettes. They didn't like him hanging around. And you see the result. That's my comment.
Yeah, Paul, thank you for the call. You know, Eric Garner case, very different than Michael Brown. I think everybody agrees with that. And I think what Paul's saying is selling Lucy's, as Eric Garner was doing, illegal or not, should we ever have a situation where police are wrestling a man to the ground if he is not exhibiting any sort of violence? Let me just kind of go around the table and let folks weigh in on what Paul wanted to say while I encourage others to join the conversation at 844-295-TALK. What do you think, Dr. McNichol?
Well, as the officer has indicated, it is very difficult to refute what you just saw. I mean, in the Michael Brown case, there was no video that precisely showed us the encounter both inside the patrol car and afterwards that we could point to and say, now at that point, you could have done A, B, or C. With Eric Garner and with the young brother in Cleveland, which I'm going to come to in a moment, there is video. So where did the other six police officers come from so quickly around Eric Garner? Why was an illegal chokehold applied? Why, when he said, I couldn't breathe, didn't somebody lighten up? And after he was lying there on the ground, why didn't somebody do something to make sure that he was not in peril? So I think, you know, it is very difficult to conclude anything other than there is almost no restraint on the amount of police force that some officers feel at liberty to use, even in pursuit of somebody whose crime was selling cigarettes one at a time. Where was the danger to the common good? Granted, it is against the law. So arrest him or fine him or send him to some sort of court, give him a summons, make him show up. But the takedown over that issue, again, because he felt himself harassed, again, bear in mind, that wasn't the first time that officer and Eric Garner had an encounter. And what he said was, not today. I'm just not going to do this again today. And they said, oh, yes, you are. And, you know, after a while, the pattern of abuse becomes so unbearable that persons just say, no, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Well, you use the term abuse, retired Sergeant Steverson. Was that abuse in the Garner case?
I would have to say that looking at the video, that there was a personality conflict. And when you, like the doctor mentioned, when you have an illegal procedure being used on someone, then you have to categorize it as what it is. It's an abuse. If you don't follow your policy, then are you not to be held to the same accountability as you would your citizen? You're breaking your policy, your department's law, so you should be held accountable for it.
Did you ever wrestle someone to the ground over a nonviolent confrontation, no physical threats?
Well, I will say this. I'm an instructor of defensive tactics for the department when I was still employed, working before I retired. And so I trained a number of officers. And with a fight, it's not choreographed. You can go from verbal to nonverbal real quick because, again, you have the four factors of being age, size, skill, sex. And then we're talking about chemical dependency or not. And many of these folk that you may deal with on the street, you don't know what they're under. They could be under the influence of alcohol or drugs. So if the dialogue turns left or right, you can find yourself fighting when you thought that all it was going to be was a normal conversation.
But Eric Garner wasn't fighting.
Well, Eric Garner, again, body language-wise, was not fighting. He was a maybe person, we call him. There's three people. You have your yes, your maybe, and your no. He was a maybe person. He wasn't fighting actively, but he was passive. And again, these individuals, rather than using some communication skills to be able to tactically turn this event around, they went hands-on and used brute force, okay? Outnumbered Eric Garner, and like the doctor was saying, you have to have someone who monitors the officer's safety, the officers, and the individual as you're taking them into custody. And that wasn't done. And because of that, we had a tragedy.
And before I get over to Mark again, I want to ask you what I asked Mark as well. You worked in Rochester Police Department for how many years?
25 years.
Did you ever hear any overt racism, the likes of which we've seen uncovered this week in Ferguson?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes. And I've had dialogue with officers because, again, Mark and my narrative is different because of our ethnicity. So what he may or may not have heard, I've heard because it was something that was probably consistent with my community. And so if someone says something, you know, unconsciously, you know, they're not aware that they're being offensive, then it's my duty to say, hey, look, you know what? That wasn't, you know, good what you said. And this is why.
And you did that.
Yes. Yeah, I had no fear with that because, again, I can say something and it be ignorantly said because I had no knowledge of being offensive. And if that person doesn't say something to me, then I'm probably going to continue
sure.
on that path.
But Marvin, isn't there something different between someone who says, who might not be trying to wound anybody, might be ignorant? There's a difference between that person and someone who says, well, don't worry, Obama won't be in office that long. How many black men hold a job for 4 years? That, there's a difference.
Oh, definitely. When you have someone that goes to that extent, and again, they did it under an anonymous a cover. You know, nobody else was going to know but myself as the sender and that other person as the receiver. Now that they're exposed,
yeah.
Whoa, yeah. Wait a minute. I really didn't mean it in that light. It was just a joke. And that's the problem with society today is that we use the pretext of jokes to put out volatile and carcinogenic type of dialogue. And that stuff will feed like cancer on a community, okay? And you can't put individual biases and institutional biases together because that's what you have. Now you have racism because these are practices that are spread within that community.
And so one of the things I want to make sure we get out of this hour is ways to be constructive going forward. And I think what you're telling us is if we all have a responsibility in our own way to call out what we see as racism when we see it.
Correct.
Because that did not happen in Ferguson. It was not called out. There was no, until this week, there was no discipline.
No. And again, they got caught. You know, the kids hand in the cookie jar, mommy, daddy caught you. Okay, know what? Now I apologize.
Yeah, you're sorry because you
I'm
got
sorry,
caught.
I'm sorry, now I got caught.
Yeah. You're not sorry because you were stealing a cookie.
You know, you got to call it what it is. And that's the only way you're going to be able to move forward progressively is to just acknowledge I was wrong and how can I make it right?
Yeah.
Well, a couple of quick comments on the Eric Garner situation. I think what Professor Stevenson was referring to when he said passive was passive resistance. It wasn't aggressive fighting, but it was still resistance. And our policies and procedures tell us that we need to use the necessary force to effect the arrest. And that's arguably was or wasn't done there. Most likely appears, obviously, because of the circumstances that force was excessive, from my opinion and also from Marv Stefferson's. But the enforcement of these some so-called, menial laws, you know, laws that are not that important, I suspect that the officers were responding to that from a citizen complaint. So you have to take that into consideration. I mean, sometimes these gathering outside of stores can be very disruptive for members of the community who own businesses.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, we can't just ignore these type of offenses. But that was the only comment I wanted to make on the Eric Garner case, which is another complex situation.
Sure.
The emails were sent on government email addresses. They weren't private emails. So that just goes another show of disrespect and disregard or a sense of impunity that I can even use my government email to send these overtly explicit and racist emails is shocking.
We're going to get to the phones in 60 seconds. We've got to get a short break in. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about moving forward after the Department of Justice report on Ferguson and just making sure that we are cognizant of of potential bias, of the way our communities are impacted by bias. And that doesn't cast any blame here. We're not making that allegation. We're trying to understand what happened there and move forward constructively with Dr. Marvin McMickle, the president of Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School, retired sergeant Marv Steverson from Roberts Wesleyan College, and I laugh because I think I almost demoted him earlier, but he was a Rochester sergeant for a number of years, and he helped develop a curriculum of an ethic and social diversity course at RWC. Mark Concordia is director of the Criminal Justice Administration program at Roberts Wesleyan and spent 13 years with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, among many other things. So let's get to that break and your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, Writers and Books has made their selection for If All of Rochester Reads the Same Book 2015. They chose The Age of Miracles, a book about the slowing of the earth. What happens when a day becomes not 24 hours, but 48 hours? How will it impact relationships and the future of mankind? The author joins me next hour on Connections.
A new poll shows that fewer young people see gender as limited to female and male. We meet transgender school children who agree.
Sometimes I say, I'm a girl. Sometimes I say, I'm a boy. Sometimes I say, does it really matter?
Students redefining gender identity. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
The rest of the hour is going to vanish quickly. Let's try to move briskly through these phone calls, and let's start with Judy in Pittsburgh. Go ahead, Judy.
Hi. I just want to add a twist on the Eric Garner case. The commissioner in New York, I can't remember his name, he said that there had been complaints about Eric Garner. What he did not say is that those complaints were by the bodega owners. And I don't know if these particular bodega owners were engaged in this practice, but many bodega owners in New York also sell Lucy's, and they were complaining because he was competition. So if they were indeed selling Lucy's themselves, then to me, the police were acting as muscle for those businesses, and they were not acting for the welfare of the basic citizen, because those people were not complaining. That's all I have to say.
Judy, thanks for the call. I can't comment. I don't know specifically. Anybody in the room? That's not something I think that we know specifically of, but I think it's if that's accurate, I think it's a fair point to raise. It's not something I had heard yet, but thanks for the call, Judy. This is John in Webster. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Evan. Thank you, and good afternoon.
Sure.
There's an explanation for the number of citations in Ferguson being 85% versus 67%, the minorities. The FBI released a report several years ago that minorities are least likely to contest their citations. An anecdote. A family member went to university, got his degree in criminal justice, went to work in the community, and started writing tickets like crazy. After 2 weeks, he was called into the office by the chief, who told him, "You're writing too many white tickets. They take us to court. We don't like to pay for those things. Concentrate on the Mexicans." Well, that community was 50% Hispanic. And my family member learned in a short while that the way to keep the grade was to ticket those people that were least likely to contest the tickets. I think that went down in Ferguson. Thank you, Evan. You have a great show.
Well, John, thank you. And if our listeners are hearing John talking about citations and thinking, but hey, we were just talking about use of force and what appears to be more ostensibly important crimes, Dr. McMickle made the point earlier this hour that those citations have an impact on someone's life. If those citations pile up, you're fined, you could lose jobs, you can go to jail. So to John's point there, I can't, again, speak to the specific instance he's talking about, Dr. McMickle, but that's essentially what you were saying earlier, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly right. For me, the issue is much larger than the vile nature of the emails, vile though they were. The real problem that people in Ferguson were complaining about, for which Michael Brown was, to use the officer's observation, the tip of the iceberg, was this persistent practice of stopping people, giving them citations, making them take off from work or not to go to court to pay them if they can't afford to pay them, and they pile up to a certain amount, off you go to jail. And you just have to ask yourself why there were that many citations issued against that part of the population with no sensitivity to the implications of what can happen over a period of time. And I think the Michael Brown incident, as tragic as it was, has to be viewed in the context of a community that had had it with the way in which police officers seemed to them to systematically target a certain part of the population.
And I'd have to concur with the doctor on the destructive cycle, because in law enforcement you see, and I use this as a discussion topic for my classes, especially in ethics and also in ethnic and social diversity, about the red light cameras. And we talk about the moral and ethical grounds for these cameras. And when you have communities who are under the poverty level and they receive a ticket that could be $100, they can't pay it. And so they don't go to court. And the ticket then becomes potential suspension on their license. And then when they're stopped for another reason, now you have unlicensed operation. You tow the vehicle, you add those expenses to it, you write multiple tickets, 2, 3, 4, 5 tickets, because there's driving without a license, and these things just begin to compound and build, and it's a destructive cycle. Now you lose your car, you can't get it out, you can't go to work. So I would agree with the doctor that those type of larger issues need to be examined.
All right, and let me also ask Mark and Marv this question. John is raising an anecdotal point, again, that I can't prove, that there have been incidents where departments, perhaps mirrored by what we're seeing in the DOJ report on Ferguson, are instructing officers to target minority populations because they won't contest tickets. Did you ever see that, Mark?
No, I never saw that. Never saw that, where that was a reason to write the tickets. You know, you always have this, arguably, this discussion of, well, tickets generate revenue. They do. But tickets also provide for road safety and vehicle and traffic safety.
Yeah.
So you can argue from either side on that. But I never saw in my, and I did spend 13 years working counterterrorism, so I was removed from the road for quite a long time. But I did never heard that mentioned here.
Okay.
In Rochester.
Okay. Marv?
Well, let's call it what it is. It's a micro inequity. And what I mean by that is that here you have an organization within an urban environment. They're told to go out and give zero tolerance, okay? Some officers like to write tickets. Some like to go out and go after drug dealers. Some like to go after the stores that sell Lucy's. So now these officers take it upon themselves to be the hero, the savior. And they will go out and enforce strict by the letter of the law. That generates a lot of numbers. Will you have that same type of policing done in a suburban or rural environment? Possibly not. And so then there comes the disparity of, well, are these officers in the city being racist, or is it just that's the organization's practice? And I would have to say, if the officers live in the suburbs, they're less likely to have that type of behavior take place out there because they're not going to tolerate being scrutinized like that. But living in the city, they're removed from their home, their residence, their place of their families residing. So they're going to conduct business with liberty. And I hate to say it because I spent 25 years wearing that badge and the gun belt. And I policed in the area that I grew up in. And I went out and wrote tickets according to what made that area safe. But not every officer polices from that position, especially when you first become an officer. You want to be very aggressive. And I think that we take a lot of times looking at aggressive policing or a high volume of policing as to be a racist behavior, and it's authorized by the department. And that's not always the case.
Well, let me follow up with one point before I get back to the phones. Ingrid and Penfield, we're coming to you in just a moment. But Marv, you grew up in Rochester.
I grew up in Rochester.
How was the neighborhood you grew up in?
I grew up at Bating Street, and at the time, Hanover Houses was still up. And, you know, people consider that to have been a rough environment.
Okay. So if you are in a department that does not, if you're not going with zero tolerance, you've got a tremendous amount of discretion, do you not?
Yes, yes.
And what you're saying is you factored in your own experience, your own upbringing to say, I'm not going to let people break the law, but I'm not going to hammer people for a minor offense every time or in case by case, I may look at this and say, hey, this could put somebody in a worse way. How can we make this better without seeing them end up in jail or with their losing their car? Is that also correct?
Correct, yes.
Okay, and so another issue that I'm hearing in Ferguson, and sometimes we hear in Rochester and other places, is if you have departments policing areas, especially urban centers, especially those conflicted with dealing with poverty, and you have officers who are from outside of the area, there's less of that rhythm of understanding, I think. Is that true?
Did not make it a yes or no answer, but to try to make it quick as possible for time's sake. What you have is when you have a community that feels devalued or dehumanized, okay, they don't have a voice, they act out in a certain way to try and get, you know, that recognition or that acknowledgement. And if the officer does not recognize from where that behavior stems from or why, then they're going to look at it as that's animalistic or violent. And so they're going to interact with that person from that standpoint. And that is where I think the communication breaks, and we say, well, you know, you see emails wherein they're talking about the black population being animals, or they're doing, you know, they speak a certain way, or they interact a certain way, because those types of stereotypes exist when there's a lack of understanding. And you have to understand who you're policing, who the community is, and where their frustration come from, and work from that capacity, so that way you can still get your job done, but you're not coming across as the overseer, as this oppressor, okay? You're not coming across as speaking down to someone. You're giving them value to their life, and in turn, you're going to get a positive response. Not always, but most times over not.
That's why Marv is teaching now. You see that? I mean, really important lessons here. Let me get back to the phones. Ingrid in Penfield. Go ahead, Ingrid. Go ahead.
I hope I'm going to be make some sense here, because I've got a lot of emotion backing this up. I am very glad about this program, and I imagine that this program is going to stop after 1 hour, and I'm sorry about that, because this is one of the most important topics I think we've got on the table in this country. And I can't fail to remember that there was a program that went into a surprise second hour, and that was the memorial service of a slain police officer in Rochester. At the time that happened, and I'm very afraid of the flack I'm going to get for saying this, I wondered why we were valuing one life above others. There were people dying in the hospital of cancer during that time, and to my eyes, we often mourn police officers more than we mourn others. And I think that a first step towards solving this problem, and as an aside, I'm quite frustrated that we're still arguing about whether it exists. It exists. The hard data's there. The anecdotes are there. It's all there. The reason we're having trouble facing it is because it is shocking, but the time for being shocked by it is past. There is white-on-black racism from the police officers in this country as a general thing. And I think a step towards addressing it would be if we could lose the Madonna whore complex we've got about police officers. They're just people. Sometimes they make bad decisions. Sometimes they make good decisions. And if we could focus on the actions they're taking and address those actions without so much passion, I think it would go a long way towards solving the problem.
Ingrid, hold on. Let me ask you two quick points here, because I want to follow up with you. Number one, you are correct in that this is a one-hour program on this show, and I said during break to our guests that it should have been two, and that they will be back, and I promise we will stay with the subject. But you're right, and I'm not going to hide behind that. I mean, that is true. But on the second point, I wanted to ask you. I understand the point that you're making, but do you look at what you're seeing in Ferguson and assume that the same thing is true in your own community?
I don't know whether it would be true to the same exact percentage point, but yes, I do.
Okay.
No doubt whatsoever. I've seen it with friends of my Facebook friends. I've read similar revolting things about the Obamas, and I'm grateful. I'm so grateful that President Obama has been our president, because it has opened my eyes to the extent of the racism in this country.
Ingrid, thanks for the call, and I really do respect the points you're making, and I promise this is not the only hour we're ever going to do on this program, but it needs to be a regular conversation. And on the note that Ingrid's making, Mark Concordia has been making the point that we have to be somewhat careful with statistics while trying to understand them as best we can, you know, diving into them. Mark, Unite Rochester has collected statistics locally. So when we see that 67% of Ferguson is black, but 85% of arrests are black, 92% of traffic stops, 94% of searches and seizures, it looks disproportionate. What Unite Rochester, you were telling me earlier, they found that it's not that different in a lot of places, including here.
No, it's not. And once again, depending on what lens you're using to interpret that data, it can be very shocking or it could be somewhat understandable in terms of the concept of disproportionality, the speaking to the larger societal issues that we have of poverty. But yeah, here locally, the Unite Rochester article, which was taken once again from the USA poll, shows that within Monroe County, the average disparity rate means blacks are arrested at a rate about six times higher than whites. And all but one department here locally showed arrest disparity rates greater than Ferguson. So once again, you can look at it and say, is this just rampant racism, or is there a complex confluence of factors that it's occurring? And I would say the latter. Racism included, some explicit, probably a good portion of it implicit. We have to understand that racism in this country has evolved, too. I think from a primitive type of biologically based beliefs to a more sophisticated racism, if I can even use those two words, where you start to judge more on poverty, mm-hmm. but it still speaks to a certain segment of our society that we shouldn't allow any of those forms. And we have to be very self-critical in our analysis. Implicit biases exist in all of us, okay? And police officers are human. And they're facing very, very difficult environments, physically, psychologically, inundated day after day after day with man's inhumanity to man. And you cannot help but affect that individual, both at a conscious level and a subconscious level.
We should not be surprised that there are higher rates of crime in impoverished areas. We should ask ourselves about concentrations of poverty, especially as it impacts our community. And in this country, minorities are more likely to be in poverty than whites, and that is, you could go back decades. You could look at housing discrimination. You could look at economic discrimination. We've talked about it on this program. That's helped set the stage for modern day. Is it impossible to get out of poverty? No. Is the deck perfectly equal for everybody? No. And so I think that Mark's right. It's complex. It doesn't mean that if more people of color are arrested, then every police officer is doing something wrong. Of course not. But I think it makes us look at the whole broader picture. So let's start to wrap the conversation. I want to go around the table, about 45 seconds apiece here. What are we going to learn from the DOJ report on Ferguson that we can all apply, Dr. McMichael, and feel like we are moving forward in a constructive way?
Your last caller, not surprisingly, brought a biblical verse to mind for me. I really affirm the risks that police officers run every day. And the argument that if you don't go out and put your life on the line every day, you don't understand their sort of mindset. I would just counter by saying, to whom much is given, of them is much required.
Yes.
And if we give you the power of arrest and we give you a gun and we give you this kind of power, we do expect that you will use that power in ways that do not disadvantage any part of the population. So I hope that we have learned that with the power that we invest in police officers, there is a heightened expectation that that power is going to be used in ways that are just and equitable.
All right. Marv, a brief closing comments here, about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
I would have to go with James Baldwin and say that, you know, white is an attitude and being black is a condition. And when we operate from the attitude and how to change it, which will impact the conditions, then you will see positive movement forward.
Are you optimistic here?
I am. I am. I truly am. I have to be, because if I give up, then I'm not being true to the humanity of us all.
Yeah. Mark?
The complexity of our societal challenges are not going to be answered anytime soon. But the law enforcement system, the criminal justice system, can take a critical look at itself and review its practices and its policies that have been in existence for years and say, what can we change? And that has to occur. Much is expected, understand, and there is a higher sense of responsibility. But we're also asking that sometimes of 21-year-olds with no education beyond a high school diploma. Fundamental shifts have to change.
Ingrid, I admit I'm raising my 3-year-old to look at police officers with a thumbs up, awe, an attitude of awe and respect, because they are willing to put their lives on the line, and I will always respect that. But I agree with what Dr. McMichael said. They are agents of our government, and they happen to be armed, and we better have high standards for them. And most of them are doing such amazing work that we should all welcome getting better, doing it better. Thanks to our wonderful panel, Marvin McMichael from Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School, Marvin Stefferson, a retired Rochester sergeant, Mark Concordia in law enforcement as well, and also Marvin Mark from Roberts Wesleyan College. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you very much.
Short break and more with you next on Member Supported Public Radio.